Thank you very much. Samuel Rutherford and the public resolutions controversy. Having witnessed the completion of the larger catechism, Samuel Rutherford left the Westminster Assembly in November 1647 with ample testimony of his learning, godliness, faithfulness, and diligence. This brought the participation of Scottish commissioners in the Assembly to an end. No doubt Rutherford was relieved to leave the religious melting pot of London with all its multiplying religious sects and a lack of uniformity. We might think that he was returning to Scotland to see the implementation of the Westminster standards he had laboured for. Yet in a very few years, his native Scotland would be marked by the appearance of some heterogeneous groups imported from England and also severe division in the national church. Cracks were already forming and quickly widening in the covenanting movement. The divide between the English Parliament and the Crown meant that it became ever more difficult to maintain a commitment to King and Covenant without choosing one over the other or compromising. Fissures soon led to outright division within the Church in the public resolutions controversy of the 1650s. It was not a division in doctrine. All were united around the Westminster Confession. It was not in worship, for they had the same form. Likewise, they were agreed in government and discipline. There was, however, a question of those to whom discipline should be applied. The state was agitating for the lifting of church discipline from those who were willing to show penitence for pursuing a course at odds with the full commitment to the covenants in taking up arms for the king. The question of whether this was right would tear apart relationships between men such as David Dixon and Samuel Rutherford, George Hutchison and James Guthrie. It created great heats of argument and made church courts virtually impossible at a higher level. You may wonder whether such a dispute is worth understanding or even possible to comprehend in its implications. Is it not best left safely in the past? No doubt there are attractions to passing over it quickly, as many historians have been inclined to do. Even James Curtin, who lived during the period, glosses over it as briefly as possible. And the Victorian James Beattie, who was the first historian to attempt to document the controversy, complained of experiencing something like the dark and perplexing mazes of a labyrinth. And any who have followed him can only look sympathetically on such sentiments. Samuel Rutherford, for all that we value him and his writings, did not come out of it altogether well. Alexander White, not the safest guide, says the following about Rutherford. He quarrelled irreconcilably with his very best friends over matters that were soon to be as dead as Aaron's golden calf and which never had more life or decency in them. The matters were so small and miserable over which Rutherford quarrelled with such men as David Dixon and Robert Blair that I could not interest you in them at this time of day, even if I tried. Yet this was the first major schism within the church after the Reformation, and as such there is surely much from it that we can learn. Considering it helps us understand how the Second Reformation, that was so promising and riding so high, ultimately seemed to fail. Whatever we think of the matter at stake, its ramifications are very far-reaching. And if we only want to learn from the attractive aspects of church history, we will have a skewed understanding of it and be more inclined to repeat the mistakes of the past because of a failure to engage with them. It is not as vital to decide what we might have done if we were in the situation as it is critical to learn from the Lord's providences in relation to the church. And despite the fact that Rutherford's spirit was not always as charitable as would be wished, there is still much that he said and wrote in relation to this dispute from which we may learn. Above all this, two of the most practical and essential books written in this period were written as a direct consequence of this division. I do not refer to any of the pamphlets written to prosecute the dispute, but to James Durham's treatise on scandal and Hugh Binning's treatise on Christian love. These invaluable publications may never have been produced were it not for the division. There are also some other curious aspects of providence, such as the fact that this period was one of revival and reform, despite the prevailing divisions. These things should prompt us to take a close interest. Well, the narrative is complex, and so we need to make a sketch of the historical context and try to bring out some aspects of the dispute and Rutherford's connection with it. We can attempt a simple historical sketch of it. The Solemn League and Covenant in 1643 bound the three kingdoms to seek reformation and unity, uniformity in religion, but also to come to each other's mutual aid in military and civil matters. When the War of the Three Kingdoms was not going Charles's way, he engaged the Marquess of Montrose to lead an army of Scots and also Irish mercenaries from the Highlands to the Lowlands in a devastating military campaign. Ultimately, he was defeated in 1645, yet it was the first time an erstwhile Covenanter had switched sides. Events took another twist when Charles surrendered to the Scots army. The Scots respectfully negotiated with him for him to own the covenant and secure the establishment of Presbyterian church government. But this was unsuccessful, and he was handed over to the forces of the English Parliament. The division began to enter the covenanting ranks through the engagement, a secret treaty entered into by Charles and commissioners from the Scottish estates. In return for certain promised concessions, religious and economic, the Scots commissioners pledged themselves to raise an army in support of the king, empowering his negotiation with the English Parliament. This brought about a rupture between the Scottish state and church, as the latter refused to support the former in this endeavour. They refused to choose between king and covenant, or to compromise the latter in favour of the former. Most of the nobility, except those like Argyll, were willing to support the Duke of Hamilton in leading the engager cause, but the church had the support of the people. Ultimately, the lackluster engager army was defeated by Cromwell at Preston after its invasion of England. The southwest of Scotland then rose in arms and marched on Edinburgh as an anti-engager force, while Perth and Stirling were taken by the engagers. Oliver Cromwell then entered the borders with his forces. A truce was formed, and Cromwell came to Edinburgh. The anti-engagers promised him that they would deal severely with the engagers, perhaps in the hopes of unifying the nation. But Cromwell pressed for this in the hopes of dividing the Scots. It was to prove too shrewd a tactic. The result was something called the Act of Classes. All rebels were deprived from all public office, either for life or for 5 to 10 years. Rutherford was on the commission of the General Assembly of the Church and actively promoting the need to purge all the rebels, lest they should invite divine wrath on the land by their holding public office. No one could be reinstated to office till they had given satisfaction to the church. Events took yet another twist when Charles I was executed, and the Scots immediately proclaimed Charles II king on condition that he would take the covenants. Negotiations then took place with Charles to that end. A division began to open up in the church commission and in the ruling powers in the state about whether Charles II was a sincere covenanted king. It was a division that would more or less parallel the later resolutions division in terms of the personalities on both sides. Many of the godly representatives found the negotiations very distasteful. Charles was clearly dissembling and insincere, surrounded by worldly courtiers. Before he was allowed to set foot on Scottish soil, he had to subscribe the covenants. On board a ship moored in the mouth of the Spey, just along the coast from Lossiemouth, Charles wanted to sign, but with reservations. This was firmly refused. John Livingston sought to persuade Charles to postpone the signing until he could do so with a full conscience. But he declined, and Livingston lamented that it was done without any evidence of a real change upon his heart and without forsaking former principles, counsels, and company. These concerns were suppressed in the report to the General Assembly. And Archibald Johnson of Warriston would later look back on these negotiations as the fountain of all our evil. Cromwell duly invaded Scotland on the 22nd of July 1650. He cleverly sought to exploit the differences between the Covenanters by speaking about the insincerity of Charles. The Scots were indeed divided as to the right course of action. Rutherford and Warriston pressed for an army purged of those officers who had been guilty of compliance through defection from the Covenants. They contended that numbers were not the primary concern, as the biblical examples of Jehoshaphat, Asa, and Amaziah showed. A declaration was prepared for Charles to sign that confessed the sins of his parents and also committed him to the Covenants, and to remove courtiers who were malignants or enemies of the Covenant. Predictably, Charles was initially unwilling to sign this humiliating document, but eventually he backed down. Rutherford, in his letters to Gilbert Kerr, who was leading the Covenanting armies, sought to strengthen him in the confidence of having a purged army. "Sir, I shall wish a clean army, so far as may be, that the shout of a king who hath many crowns may be among you, and that you may fight in faith and prevail with God first." There was the hope that victory in the impending battle against Cromwell's forces would both vindicate the purges and consolidate their influence in church and state. After some skirmishes around Edinburgh, Cromwell retreated southwards towards Dunbar with thoughts of returning to England by sea. The Scots held the position of advantage and outnumbered the English by 2-1, but they squandered this by charging down to meet them at the Battle of the 3rd of September 1650 and were duly routed. Cromwell then marched on Edinburgh and Glasgow. The defeat hit Rutherford hard. He wrote to William Guthrie shortly afterwards, "I have suffered much, but this is the thickest darkness and the straitest step of the way I have yet trodden." A few days after Dunbar, Warriston, James Guthrie, Rutherford, Patrick Gillespie and others took the initiative to draw up some causes for a public fast and send them to the presbyteries in the name of the Commission of the General Assembly. In it, they named the sins that they believed caused the defeat at Dunbar. These were largely either the sins of the king's household or the sins of the nation's civil and military leaders. The paper ended with a call for the entire nation to acknowledge these sins, repent of their compliance with malignants, and cleave faithfully to the truth and the covenant and cause of God. Others thought differently, and the differences could be stated in this question: did they need to seek a purer army and ruling officials, or did they need to make use of those who were guilty of previous defections in the present extremity? A couple of days after the defeat, Rutherford expressed the opinion to Kerr that our army, through the sinful miscarriage of men, hath fallen, and dare say it is a better and more comfortable disposition than if the Lord had given us the victory. This articulates the views of those who would later be called protesters that the army was not purged enough. The commission came to agree with the state that repentant engagers could be restored to positions in the army. This ultimately paved the way for pressure to rescind the active classes to allow those under discipline to be restored to church privileges and public office. Parliament pressed the commission for their approval and received no opposition. Some ministers maintained, however, that the sudden receiving of so many profane and malignant men into the government, when there was just ground to suspect their professions, would result in the overthrow of the covenants and the cause of God and lead to the oppression and persecution of the people of God. The key covenanting ministers were not in attendance at the latter meetings of the Commission, and when Parliament rescinded the Act of Classes, the Commission threatened all opponents with discipline. These decisions were to be ratified at the General Assembly in July 1651. Some, like Robert Bailey, were incensed at this decision being forced on the Church in a way that was inevitably going to create division. The Assembly had been forced to adjourn from St Andrews to Dundee due to the advancing English armies, and the representation was very inadequate. A protest signed by 22 ministers was given in against the lawfulness of the Assembly, with Rutherford's name at the top of the list. Three of the leading protesters were deposed, as previous legislation against those who declined the authority of the General Assembly was brought into operation. Rutherford wrote to Patrick Gillespie that he should disregard his deposition, as indeed he did. In the same letter, Rutherford says, "Schoolheads talk of fundamentals and non-fundamentals, and say they, the present controversy is not about fundamentals. Ministers may keep their places, peace, and stipends, and make less din. But are non-fundamentals nothing? Sir, you divide not from others for nothing. You contend not for nothing. You suffer not for nothing. They that will be unfaithful in little will be unfaithful in much. Mistake me not, as if I thought the ground of your testimony a little thing and a trifle. I think you and all that be faithful to God are bound to follow it, to bonds and to blood, that Christ ought to be a king in Scotland, and the people ought to employ the liberty that Christ hath bought to them with his blood, is among fundamentals with me. And whether the way man gives and allows to men that have fought against the truth be not naturally and by interpretation against this, judge." Although one can understand the reasoning, it is difficult to avoid the impression that this ratcheted up the stakes to the most serious possible level and made reconciliation exceedingly difficult. It was rather a different approach from the exceptional sermon preached by James Durham before the Glasgow and Ayr Synod in October 1652. This showed that it was both possible and absolutely necessary to unite, and gave rules to attain to union. The sermon on Ephesians 4, verse 11 to 12, observed that neither union nor edification would result from any one side being defeated or driving one party's interests. The apostle says, "Be of one mind, live in peace." Durham says that if we cannot do the first, we certainly ought still to do the second and pursue forbearance. "Be much about the main things of edifying souls, for it is the cure of division," he said. Durham challenged the synod, "Look through our congregations. Since these last distractions and differences, have they brought more spiritual growth and grace, or won souls to Christ, or increased edification?" It is a thoroughly spiritual sermon that fosters a highly spiritual outlook on the work of the ministry and church government. Returning to the matters at stake, we might ask, why did Rutherford protest against the General Assembly, and why could he not have dissented with reasons merely? It was because he objected to the very lawfulness and constitution of the Assembly, and believed that the Church had denied its covenant and solemn vows. While he looked for purity and believed it is a sin to be coagents with the errors of a church, he did not think a church can be perfect in this life and must be deserted for faults. He was of the view that obedience was only commanded in the Lord, or for lawful decisions of the superior court. The Assembly issued a warning and declaration directed against the protesters. The protesters, for their part, circulated something penned by Rutherford for strengthening and clearing the grounds of the protestation and taking off such objections as are usually made to the same. Rutherford was, in effect, the leader of the protesters at this point, and perhaps the leading theologian of the time. Warriston provided legal expertise for the protesters, and no one was a better politician and strategist than Patrick Gillespie. James Guthrie was an exceptional reasoner and propagandist. Scotland was largely brought under the power and control of Cromwell by 1652. It was incorporated into one commonwealth with England and Ireland. The boroughs were obliged to give their assent to a tender of union and through elected deputies to consent to the incorporation of Scotland into England. How should Scots respond to Cromwell since they believed he had usurped civil government in Scotland? Rutherford wrestled with this question in the unpublished treatise on the nature of obedience to a usurped power. He believed the occupation of Scotland was a result of the permissive providence of God, and he counseled patience and urged Scots to make virtue of necessity. He gave the following analogy of a hijacked vessel. If a shipmaster had been taken and bound by force, and the ship steered to another harbour, the shipmaster requires and exhorts the steersman not to run the ship aground. It was therefore lawful to obey the commands of the usurper, but only upon supposition that he act the prince's part. It was a de facto rather than a de jure power, and so they were not to give free consent to unjust conquerors, nor to give the formal power magistratical to them as lawful magistrates because of the present necessity. He was therefore against those occupying civil office submitting to Cromwell and giving an oath of allegiance called the tender, which legitimised his rule. It was contrary to the covenant to swear never by lawful and innocent ways to vindicate our own liberty, he said, and for these reasons Rutherford decided to bar from the Lord's table at the Fife parish of Scooney all who had taken the tender. Rutherford believed that attempts to restore Charles II would fail and that Cromwell's regime would also fail due to their faults in the eyes of the Lord, and therefore he was against complying with any of them. He believed that the Scots were to endure the protectorate regime as a just punishment of our iniquity and not to do anything against the safety and settled peace and government of the Commonwealth. There were two texts that Rutherford commended as mottos for the situation. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned, and I was dumb and opened not my mouth because thou did it. There were many publications at this time. In March 1653, a meeting of protesters issued a testimony against the English actings in Scotland. Rutherford prepared this along with Andrew Cant and James Guthrie. It certainly bears the hallmarks of his language, with remonstrations against the way that the English rulers had broken the covenant, but also ends with strong desires for a covenanted unity to be restored. The breach between the protesters and resolutioners was widened by delays in negotiations, pamphlet warfare, constant separate meetings and fasts, provocative actions, rival ordinations, and entrenched positions. Neither seemed willing to follow the course of mutual condescending that James Durham would later recommend. They only looked for the other side to retreat. Warriston and Guthrie led the offensive on their side, while Patrick Gillespie was manoeuvring into favour and influence with the Protector. Rutherford was drawing nearer to seeking reconciliation by the time of the 1653 General Assembly. But that meeting refused a conference with the protesters beforehand, which inevitably triggered yet another protest and a separate meeting. The separate General Assemblies were then forcibly suppressed by Cromwell's armies with great protests, and no General Assembly was ever again to meet until 1690, almost 40 years after the last undivided one. It is hard to consider that without some acknowledgement of the Lord's chastisement on the church. James Durham and Robert Blair organised a meeting at Edinburgh in June 1655 to reconcile the two parties. Their proposals were well received, but Warriston and Guthrie would have no union without a severe purge, which effectively meant protester control of the church. Durham would later argue in his famous book that discipline should not be preferred before union. Rutherford was not present. On one such occasion, he had impatiently remarked that he had heard much about peace with man, but little about peace with God. But now he seems to have grown weary of all the disputing. Durham and Blair concluded that as long as Warriston and Mr. James Guthrie did guide that party, there could be no peace possible. The plan of the latter was to prepare a new national covenant for signing up and down the land, which would then become a standard of discipline. But this initiative showed that the protesters, already a small group themselves, were further dividing into different parties. Truly, as Proverbs says, the beginning of strife is as when one letteth out water. It will take its own course. We do not know where it will end and what damage it will wreak. Solomon goes on to counsel, therefore leave off contention before it be meddled with. Sadly, the divisions affected the preaching of even the most eminent ministers as they brought references to the controversy into their sermons. It was not a constant feature, of course, but it was evident. James Ferguson, whom James Stirling described as an ardent upholder of the resolutions, on one occasion attacked the protesters from his pulpit, especially William Guthrie. Hugh Peebles, minister of Lochwinnoch, spoke to him about this, and Ferguson admitted it with tears. He spoke of how he himself felt mistreated in the presbytery meetings. But Peebles said, "Does this look like you, Mr. Ferguson, your wisdom and prudence, to carry to such a minister of the gospel as Mr. Guthrie is?" Peebles arranged for both men to preach at his communion, probably about 1653. And when they both arrived, they both threatened to leave if the other remained. But they were persuaded to stay and preach and promised not to refer to controversial matters. After they heard each other preach, they embraced one another, being both greatly appreciative of the other's sermon. There are notes of many of Rutherford's sermons and expositions from the 1650s, but as these are mostly not transcribed, it is difficult to say how much the controversies entered into his pulpit discourses. He certainly took opportunities to address the matters under debate at times. One day when preaching in Edinburgh, possibly around the time of the 1653 assembly, since many eminent ministers and elders were present, we're told he fell upon these sad differences of the protestation and public resolutions. After he had been a while discoursing on these differences, he breaks out in these expressions, "Woe is us for these sad differences and divisions that makes us lose the fair scent of the rose of Sharon." And then he fell out in commending of Christ, going over all his precious titles and styles, about half a quarter or a quarter of an hour. And Glanderson said in the meantime, "Now you are right, hold you there." No doubt we would agree with the Laird of Glanderson in this. It certainly seems that the Christ-exalting strain was more common in Rutherford's preaching. William Tulloduff was a student of Rutherford's from around 1648 onwards, and he said that many times he thought Mr. Rutherford would have flown out of the pulpit when he came to speak of Christ, the Rose of Sharon. Then he was as a fish in the ocean. He was never in his right element, but when he was speaking of Christ and commending him. But he was not, however, averse to bringing in the controversial matters even during communion seasons. On one occasion at St. Andrew's, some came all the way from Galloway to hear Rutherford. The latter, says Robert Woodrow, however, being naturally hot and fiery, ran to a sad height and refused to serve a table with Messrs. Blair and Wood. After all the entreaty they could make, at length Mr. Blair was forced to serve it himself. When he began, he was exceedingly damped with Mr. Rutherford's carriage, and began to this purpose, "We must have water in our wine while here, oh, to be above, where there will be no mistakes." Woodrow continues, "Yet Mr. Rutherford was to preach in the afternoon after the tables, and did so, but was remarkably deserted. Some people that came to the communion from Galloway remarked it and lamented over the division. There were few people that Rutherford respected more than Blair. He always called him sir and offered him his place, and therefore he must have felt this as keenly as Blair did himself. It is not clear whether the reference to Rutherford being deserted in the afternoon preaching is to the measure of liberty experienced or the numbers who'd gathered to hear him. It seems that he chose in this afternoon or evening service to make reference to the differences between the resolutioners and protesters. He spoke with some keenness, which very much surprised the good people who had come all the way from Galloway. And Robert Blair, when they spoke to him about it, said this was water to their wine, and it was necessary sometimes to have wine mixed. While there were negative aspects of separation, there were also positive benefits in the gathered communions. There were large gatherings of people, and it is thought that the Thursday fast day originates from this time. They were rather different events, however, to later practice, with as many as 10 consecutive sermons sometimes being preached on such fast days. Certainly, the quantity of sermons preached by Andrew Gray at a single communion season at Bothwell indicates that there were very many services held over the course of such weekends. They became a focus for times of revival, as we'll continue to consider in a moment. But in the 1657 pamphlet, The True Representation, the resolutioners alleged that these gatherings were motivated by a desire to promote the party interest of the protesters. Well, to move on to some of Rutherford's arguments at this time. In 1658, a book appeared in Scotland entitled A Survey of the Survey of That Sum of Church Discipline, penned by Mr. Thomas Hooker. It had been sent to London for printing in 1655, but polemics against Congregationalism did not seem as essential as at that time as they had been in the previous decade. Indeed, it may not have seemed politic for the English Presbyterians to attack independency when Cromwell was in the ascendant, and so it lay neglected. Writing at the height of the divisions in Scotland, Rutherford had included an address to the Christian reader that took his own church and the dominating resolutioner party roundly to task as covenant breakers and consorters with malignants. It is true that at one stage Rutherford expressed closer sympathy with the independents, writing in 1644, "The best of the people are of the independent way." But by 1648, he had witnessed enough of independents contending for a very wide toleration of all kinds of heterodox opinions that he saw it as eminently dangerous. Rutherford also needed to resist the encroachments of independency on the ranks of the protesters themselves. On the one hand, he resisted the arguments of the resolutioners in aspects of church power, and on the other hand, he had to contend with independency. The Aberdeen minister, Alexander Jaffrey, conversed with Cromwell and John Owen during his imprisonment after the Battle of Dunbar, and this led him to promote independency. He led a group of Aberdeen dissenters who threatened to separate in 1652 because of the impurities they believed to be infecting the church. It seemed that they were pushing the protester arguments far further than was wished. Now it... Rutherford went to Aberdeen to meet with them and also to write a treatise to answer their objections within the space of about a week. And this treatise largely survives in manuscript. He pleaded with them not to separate. Whatever be the remedy, a sinful separation is not the remedy, but worse than the disease. And he asked, doth it not add oil to the fire to separate? His pleading was not successful, however, as the group in Aberdeen did move to independency and then subsequently Quakerism. And now, as I mentioned, this was a period of revival. The protester minister, Robert Law, commented that in the west of Scotland, it is not to be forgotten that from the year 1652 to the year 1660, there was great good done by the preaching of the gospel in the west. John Livingston speaks of great blessing in the East and the borders at the same time, with people flocking to communions. James Kirkton records his well-known glowing testimony to this period. He said that more souls were converted at this time than any other, and the ordinances were never more purely administered. And it is indeed fair to say that the protester and resolutioner dispute did not affect the advance of Reformation on a local level. Discipline was still faithfully administered, and the work of the gospel progressed. The divisions led to some very profitable books that responded directly to the schisms, especially those by Hugh Binning and James Durham. It could also be that the distasteful aspect of the controversy prompted Rutherford to focus on more profitable themes. The Covenant of Life Opened was published along with the eminently practical and spiritually helpful book Influences of the Life of Grace. Resolutioner brethren such as Ferguson, Hutchison, and Dick Dixon gave themselves more to the production of the highly valuable expositions of Scripture that appeared at this time. Lest I seem to have highlighted the negative aspects of Rutherford's conduct at this time, the following is a valuable window into his personal spiritual experience. A servant woman that was in Mr. Guthrie's house said that she observed Mr. Rutherford in his chamber, walking alone and meditating and praying. She observed him have these three petitions at some little distance after one another. When he walked sometime, she heard him say, "Lord, make me believe in thee." And then he sat down and mused sometime. He rose again and walked. She heard him say, "Lord, make me love thee," and then sat down again. And again he rose and uttered these words, "Lord, make me keep all thy commandments." His health began to decline markedly in the last years of the 1650s, and this may explain why records of his preaching are more scarce in relation to the last year or two of his life. Before Rutherford died, he wanted to leave behind a written testimony as to his views. Apparently, this was either written out or dictated by him on the last day of February 1661, but it was not published until 1718, when it appeared under the title The Testimony to the Covenanted Work of Reformation in Britain and Ireland. It begins with the desire that Christ's throne would be exalted above the heavens, but immediately is concerned to qualify that he is not aligning himself with the kind of premillennial views of the independents or other groups. I mean not any such visible reign of Christ on earth as the millenaries fancy. Rutherford is evidently concerned to disown any shared convictions with the English Fifth Monarchy men of the period, who would lead a failed rising in January 1661, only weeks earlier. Just because he had argued for purging the Scottish army raised to fight Cromwell, he had not moved to this radical position. Yet Rutherford does enter into a reflective spirit. While he does not go as far as James Guthrie in questioning the degree to which people were compelled to subscribe the covenants, he does regret the rush to use church discipline in the struggle. Afterwards, our work was too much in sequestration of estates, fining and imprisoning, more than in a compassionate mournfulness of spirit towards those whom we saw to oppose the work, he wrote. In our assemblies, we were more to set up a state opposite to a state, more upon forms, citations, leading of witnesses, suspensions from benefices, than spiritually to persuade and work upon the conscience with the meekness and gentleness of Christ. Again, there's a clear regret of the strong arming of those who were opposed or reluctant through church discipline. He uses the language "we" to identify him with these excesses. Had they escalated events and opposition by their actions? Had their overdoing led to an undoing? Had they stumbled many against the rightness of their cause by the way in which they had pursued it? There are lessons for us, no doubt, in this. How easy it is to hold the truth with a pitchfork or wielding a stick rather than to speak the truth in love. The Apostle Paul frequently requires the patience that Rutherford desires. In his soul searching, Rutherford has not changed his position, but he does express repentance for the methods and approaches used. It was a heart rather than a head problem, Rutherford says. If the meekness and gentleness of our Master had got so much place in our hearts that we might have waited on gainsayers and parties contrary-minded, and we might have driven gently as our Master Christ, who loves not to overdrive, but carries the lambs in his bosom. And when we think of how some men like William Colville were deposed merely for failing to speak against the engagement, we must wonder at the extent to which discipline was pressed at that time. It is altogether possible that Rutherford had read and absorbed his friend James Durham's book, published in 1659, A Treatise on Scandal or a Dying Man's Testament to the Church of Scotland, which was issued after Durham's death. It was important for the context of the 1650s in relation to the first two parts, as well as the fourth part, which deals at length with divisions and how they may be healed. The first part covers the way in which we may be guilty of stumbling others as to their edification, not so much in the rightness of our words and actions, but in the way we go about them. The second part deals with church discipline as the means for removing public scandals. Durham emphasizes that this is a means ordained of God not for punishment, but for edification. It is medicinal rather than punitive, and therefore will vary in relation to those to whom it is administered. Rutherford seems to be implying that they had allowed the spirit of sequestrations, finings, and imprisonments to enter into the exercise of a spiritual ordinance. They had used it for offences that were more civil in nature. Perhaps, and we can only conjecture, Rutherford had been helped by Durham to see how the spirit of Christ should imbue the work of church discipline. We can certainly say that it is the book on the subject best fitted to do so for anyone. Rutherford was placed under house arrest and facing the prospect of the gallows. His natural death alone preserved him from that. He acknowledged his own faults, but showed a determination to adhere to his principles and the matters at stake in the resolution's controversy. "I have my own guiltiness, like any other sinful man," he said, "but he hath pardoned and loved and washed and given me joy unspeakable and full of glory. I repent not that ever I owned his cause. These whom we call protesters are the witnesses of Jesus Christ. I hope never to depart from that cause, nor side with those that have burnt the causes of God's wrath." He wanted the men from the presbytery to take a message to the presbytery as a dying man. He charged them to appear for God in his cause, to adhere to the doctrine of the covenants. "Have a care of the flock committed to your charges. Feed the flock out of love. Preach for God. Visit and catechize for God. Do all for God. Beware of men pleasing. The chief shepherd will appear shortly. Take this commission from me, my dear brethren. All the personal griefs and wrongs they have done to me, I cordially and freely forgive them, as I desire my Lord to forgive me. I have been a wretched, sinful man. I have had my own failings, but my Lord hath pardoned and accepted my labors. I adhere to the cause and covenants, and mind never to depart from that protestation against these controverted assemblies." Some spoke of his faithfulness and diligence, but he said, "I disclaim all. That is the port that I would be in at, redemption through his blood and forgiveness." Mr. Blair said, "Shall I praise the Lord for all the mercies he has done for you and is to do?" Rutherford answered, "Oh, for a well-tuned harp." Well, in conclusion, this sad division was never in fact healed. In fact, perhaps it was revived somewhat in later contentions during the time of persecution. It is hard to read the Resolutionary Ferguson's exposition of Galatians 5:15 without thinking he had the current divisions in mind. He points out the great difficulty of maintaining love and tenderness where there are different divisions in opinion. He points out that Galatians 5:15 speaks of mutual biting and devouring one another, because in a time of division, even when we might be defending truth, there is a danger that we vent much of fleshly zeal and passion. As the historian Callum Wright has put it, the acrimonious divisions between the protesters and the resolutioners in the 1650s severely damaged the Kirk's claims to represent the collective conscience. Their competition for the favour of the English government had allowed a passive spirit among them, so that they did not resist or protest as vigorously and vocally as they ought at the time of Charles's restoration. Like Rutherford, the protesters were able to reflect on their contribution to this state of affairs. The naivety of the resolutioners was seen in their trust in the double-dealing hypocrisy of James Sharp, who was negotiating for episcopacy while supposedly representing their interests. After 12 years of arguing how to manage Presbyterianism, that form of church government was removed by the Stuart regime. Following years of debate as to how to relate to the nobility and the support of Charles II, the latter rounded on them all and robbed them of the church power the graceless had despised so much. The cold light of day now dawned on the leading resolutioners, as many of the parish ministers supporting them now embraced episcopal rule. Robert Bailey died in partial denial but brokenhearted over the church's demise. The protesters and resolutioners had different emphases on aspects of Presbyterian polity and church power, and also different articles in the Solemn League and Covenant, so that the covenants now came to stress the disunity and not the unity of Scotsmen. We could ask who was right. We could read James Guthrie's Protesters, No Subverters, and take one side, then read James Wood's A True Representation of the Rise, Progress, and State of the Present Divisions in the Church of Scotland, and take the other side. And then truly, we might conclude with Durham that we should refuse to take either side because division was worse than both. Men like Robert Douglas, David Dixon, and James Wood came to recognise that the protesters had been the truer prophets. Perhaps they were all able to see, as John Brown of Haddington said of a later division, our conduct on both sides I have often thought to be like that of travellers, both walking on the same road, not far from one another, but in consequence of a thick mist suddenly coming on, they cannot see one another and can suppose the other to be off the road. After some time, the darkness is removed, and they're quite surprised to find that they're both on the road and had been all along so near one another. Well, the protesters and resolutioners went out into the wilderness together, united in suffering. It was the revival of the 1650s and the fortitude of the younger men ordained after 1648 that sustained the people's commitments to Presbyterianism during the time of persecution. Before long, all these men involved in the controversy would join the General Assembly of the Firstborn. They joined what Rutherford called in his book, Christ Dying and Drawing Sinners to Himself, a General Assembly of immediately illuminated divines round about the throne who study, lecture, preach, praise Christ night and day. Oh, what rays, what irradiations and dartings of intellectual fruition, beholding, enjoying, living in him, and fervour of loving come from that face, that God visage of the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb that is in the midst of them, and overcovers, weights, and loads the beholders within and without. And then there must be reflections and reachings of intellectual vision, embracing, loving, wondering, returning back to him again in a circle of glory. And then who but the bridegroom and the spouse, the Lamb's wife, in an act of an eternal espousing, marrying and banqueting together, who but Christ and his followers, who but the all in all, the I am, the Prince of Ages. This is where they all are, and that is where we shall leave them, above all controversies, united in the blessed vision of the Lamb.